Well, good morning. I'm so glad to be here. I'm Ryan Lenners. I'm a team pastor here at Ashworth Road. And along with Brent, I say welcome. Glad to have you with us. Today, I'm really excited to be continuing our series that we're calling God Is, fill in the blank here. We've been going through the character traits of God. And long before we began this series, as we were on the whiteboard writing out all the things that we could teach on this, this topic that we have for today, I was really, really excited about. I'm like, okay, we have to do this topic, and I have to be the one who gets to teach you about this character trait. And the reason I wanted to teach on this topic is because, for many, it's actually a really hard pill to swallow. It's one of those character traits that leaves us kind of scratching our heads, not because it's a big word, like when we learned that God was omniscient or that God was sovereign. This is actually one of the traits that we're most familiar with. It's one of the traits that we think of most often, and it's just one of those traits that we never attribute to God. God is jealous. We think we understand what jealous is, but we rarely ever think of God as being the one who's jealous. And so that's why I'm so excited about this message, because I love to teach things that are new for most people. And it's not that I only look for things that are obscure in the Bible. Some people might think I do that sometimes with my love of the Old Testament. But what we never do here is we never take a phrase of the Bible that's kind of a gray area that people differ on and say, okay, we're going to teach this little thing and we're going to pull a main thing out of a little thing. What we're talking about today is actually mentioned over 25 times in the Bible, very directly stated. For instance, the verse that I want us to look at is in Exodus chapter 34, verse 14. And that's where we're going to go first. And it's very clear what God is saying about this, but so often when we read through the Bible, we miss these things. Isn't it funny? I'm sure there are many of you who have read through the Bible several times in your lives. You've read it cover to cover. You've been reading it for years. And there's sometimes, I'm sure, that you sit in a message, probably not mine, one of Brent's, he's good at this, where he'll teach something and you'll be like, I've never thought of it that way. I've never read that. I've read through that passage, but I never thought of it like that. And so there's these times where sometimes we're reading quickly through things, or we're not slowing down to really consider what the meaning is of passages, and we can fall into a trap of reading through the Bible without ever actually considering what it means for us, what it means about God and who He is and His interactions with us. And as a result, sometimes when we do that, there are people who are like, will say, well, I've read the Bible through before. I've read a bunch of parts of it, and none of it makes any sense to me. That's just some old, dry book. It has nothing for me today. And so that's why we hope that days like this, where we bring the message to you, we can show you something that maybe you've just skimmed over before, something that you've read, you've thought about, but never thought deeply about what the implications are. And hopefully we can bring that to life. And so, like I was saying, going to Exodus chapter 34, verse 14, I'll let God introduce to you this topic in very blunt terms that He puts it when talking to the Israelites. He tells them, "The Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God." He couldn't be any more blunt about this, right? This is very, very crystal clear. He is saying, "I am jealous. My name is jealous. It's who I am. It's in my character that I'm jealous." This idea of saying, my name is jealous, that's a really significant way for him to say, jealous isn't an attribute I sometimes have, like a toddler who you're holding a toy the toddler wants. At that moment, the toddler is jealous, right, for the toy. No, God is saying, it is deep inside the core of my character that I am a jealous God. In the same way that I am, like we've learned in previous weeks, an infinite God, or a sovereign God, or a holy God, in the same way that all those things are core to who I am at all times, I am a jealous God. My name is Jealous. It's who I am. He's telling us very, very clearly. For many of you, though, that probably sits as a bit of a surprise. Even though maybe you've read it or maybe you've heard it, you're sitting there scratching your head saying, okay, But how can God be jealous if we are told as Christians that's supposed to be a bad thing, aren't we? Aren't there those verses, Ryan, that say we're not supposed to be jealous, we're not supposed to covet? And yes, you are exactly right. There's several verses in the New Testament. The one I picked to show you is the famous verse that's used in nearly every wedding ceremony from 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 4. Love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful or proud or rude. And it continues. So then how can God be jealous if it's a sin for us to be jealous? That seems like a contradiction, doesn't it? But I hope that by unpacking this seeming conflict, that it leads to all of us today understanding God so much better. So first, to begin by unpacking, how can God say, I am jealous, and we know God is love, and then we have this 1 Corinthians passage that says, love is patient and kind and is not jealous. That just seems like a contradiction. How do we get there? First, we need to start by defining the word jealous. And so I, of course, just opened up Merriam-Webster, and I read the definition, and I went, this is perfect. I'm so glad this definition is exactly where I wanted to go with this. And we read in Merriam-Webster, jealous is the first definition. There were like three or four of them. These are the two that line up really well. The others you'd also agree with. Intolerant of rivalry or unfaithfulness. The second one, vigilant in guarding a possession. And now for most of us, when we hear the word jealous and we think about these definitions, we very much might picture the teenage girl who's got a brand new boyfriend. And she is very jealous of everything about him. How come you didn't call me last night? Why were you talking to her? How come you took 5 minutes to text me back on the phone? Why this? Why that? Why aren't you wearing the shirt that I bought you? And the guy's going, whoa, a little bit controlling, don't you think? That's what we think of, this intolerant of rivalry. It's that young love where they have this jealousy that's really immature, really selfish, really sinful. Or we might think of a child who's unwilling to share his toys with another. You know, you have the toddlers and you give them the toy and you're like, now share it. And they're like, no. They bare their teeth at you. They growl. They're like, I am guarding my possession. And you go, well, Ryan, that's what I think of when I think of jealous. So how does that line up with God? These situations look like immaturity, somebody trying to control. These are selfish and sinful situations. And this is why it's hard for us to wrap our hands around the idea of God being a jealous God. But let's step back and look at that definition again. What if instead of applying this definition to the teenager who's immature or the toddler, we applied it to a marriage? What if we said, okay, one spouse is being jealous for the other spouse by being intolerant of rivalry or unfaithfulness? It's the spouse who looks at, you know, the other and sees that somebody or something is trying to seduce their spouse, trying to say, hey, you know, wouldn't you like to spend time with me? Maybe it's an activity or a hobby that's consuming all of their time and breaking apart the marriage. Maybe it's a person who apparently has the hots for your wife or your husband, and you're like, I don't think that's right. As the husband, it's okay for me to step in and say, you know what? I am intolerant of this. You please go your separate way. I am going to guard my wife. I'm going to be vigilant in making sure that this doesn't happen. I view my wife as a possession, not like she's a thing to me, but God has given her to me. God has entrusted my wife to me as a good gift. And he's saying, you know what? I understand. I need to guard her. I need to protect her. I need to make sure that she doesn't fall into bad things or into danger. So when we look at this view of jealous and we apply it to a marriage, we go, that makes a lot of sense. In a marriage, yes, you should be intolerant of rivalry for somebody competing for your spouse's time or faithfulness. You should be vigilant in guarding them and protecting them. That just makes sense to us. But now we have these two seemingly conflicting ideas about jealousy in mind. We see one as the teenager or the toddler who are selfish, but then we see it in view of marriage and we go, well, that might be okay, all right? So how do we differentiate jealousy in a good way or jealousy in a godly way or jealousy in a selfish way? And the first form of jealousy, I would define it as being the selfish and sinful way, where it's all about you. It's not about the other person. It's about what you want. You're jealous of the other person. You're jealous of what they have. You're jealous of maybe what they're doing. You're jealous of their vacation. You see those pictures on Facebook and you're like, how come I can never go on those nice vacations? How come they always get to go to the great places? Or you're jealous of their promotion. You know, I was the next in line. Why did they get that nice job, that corner cubicle, and I'm stuck doing the same old thing? You can be jealous of just about anything. You can be jealous of an in-person's entire life. How come they have the nice house and they have the better kids and they don't have anything hard happen to them and they never get sick and everything good always happens to them? Whatever it is, I'm sure all of us can think of times, maybe now in our life or at another point in our lives, where we have been jealous of another person, right? Nod your heads with me. I'm not the only one. It's human nature, right? And we recognize that that's not right. An interesting thing when I looked through numerous Bible verses and across different translations, is that this selfish jealousy, which is described as sinful and something for Christians to avoid in the Bible, is almost always translated as envy. Okay? Even if you notice when I pulled up that quote from 1 Corinthians, I had to pull a specific version to find the word jealous because all the other versions use the word envy. Okay, almost every single place in the Bible that you see it described on a sin list, or don't be like this, don't do that, the word is almost always put in the Bible as envy. And in the New Testament, there are only four places that most Bibles put the word jealous, and in each case, it's about God or Paul being jealous for other Christians in a godly way. Okay, so we have to, while in America here, we kind of look at envy and jealousy, see them as completely synonymous. I can use them completely interchangeably. When you're reading your Bible, what you'll see is that envy is kind of this selfish jealousy we're not supposed to do. But the word jealous is almost always used about God and how he feels towards his people. Okay, so that's the first form of jealousy. The second form of jealousy is the mature and the godly form, like I've talked about. It's others-focused, and it's based on profound passion for another person. This might be when a parent sees a child being drawn into a bad crowd and says, hey, you know what? I'm going to step in here. You need to stop hanging out with those friends, and you need to come back to the family and be a part of us. And the child, meanwhile, is looking at mom and dad and being like, why are you being so controlling? Why are you stepping into my life? This is terrible. This is awful. You're so controlling. And the parent's saying, you know what? I love you. I care about you. And as a result of that, I'm pursuing you, and I'm trying to protect you, guard you. Does that sound like the version of jealousy, the definition we had, right? That's a godly jealousy. And this word is closely related to the word zeal, okay? And zeal is defined as an eagerness and pursuit of something. That's what zeal is. I found our word jealous actually comes from the same Latin word for zeal. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Jealous and zealous. They sound a lot alike, don't they? There's a reason for that. But that's the second form of jealousy. That's a godly jealousy. And as you can see, it's the second form, this idea of God's jealousy as zeal for his people that God is conveying to us when he repeatedly tells us across the Bible that he is a jealous God. Okay? He's not envious of anything. He's jealous for us. So moving forward, now let's look at God's jealousy and its impact on our lives. So would you open to Exodus chapter 20? That's where our primary text is going to be for the rest of this message. Exodus chapter 20. And Exodus chapter 20 is actually, it's at the very beginning of the Bible. It's just the second book in. And we are at a crossroads in the story of God when we get to this chapter. What's happened, to bring you up to speed if you don't know, is early in the Bible, God picks out Abraham and says, Abraham, you know what? You are a righteous, faithful man, and I'm going to make you the father of a great nation. And so Abraham has a really big family, and that family continues to get bigger. And then they end up being oppressed in Egypt. And God sets them free from Egypt. He leads them out of the slavery of Egypt. They cross the Red Sea. He's got some over 1 million people out in the wilderness. And it's at this point God has his people, and he's going to give them his law. And that's where we pick up in Exodus chapter 20. Whether you're Christian or not, you know what's in here. It's the Ten Commandments. Everybody's familiar with the Ten Commandments. Charlton Heston made them famous for everybody in America. And that's where we begin reading in verse 1 of chapter 20. And God spoke all these words, "I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me." Isn't that interesting? Here we see God first describing that he is your God. He's not just saying, "I am God and here are the laws." He's first saying, "I am your God. I am the one who delivered you. I am the one who made the covenant with your ancestor, Abraham. I am yours. You are my people. We are in relationship together." It's almost like he's reminding them of this covenant relationship that he made with Abraham over 400 years earlier. And that covenant relationship, we really have to think of that as something like a marriage, okay? His relationship with Abraham saying, "You will be my people," it was a covenant the way that we think of marriage. And what that means is that there is going to be one partner in the marriage. Just like we have in our marriage, there is one partner in this covenant. And that's why in verse 3, God lays out the first commandment. And that first commandment he lays out is, "You shall have no other gods before me." Number one law you need to know, no other gods. He's saying, "You're my people, I'm your God, we're married. We're not letting anybody else into this marriage, okay? It's you and it's me. And we're together." God's not going to allow any other lovers, nothing else that might draw away their attention or their focus or their love. And then he continues in verse 4 and 5. We read, "You shall not make for yourself," this is the second commandment, "you shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God." Here it is again, clear as day. God's reason for why he lays out the first and the second commandments is because he is a jealous God. It's who he is. And now I know many of you maybe have read these verses before, but have you ever considered the significance of this statement? He drops that he is jealous right in the middle of the Ten Commandments, and so often we've probably missed it. But here it is. And when we start to put these things together, it only makes sense to us that God is a jealous God. If God is in a covenant relationship with his people, and that covenant is like a marriage, let's consider this logically. He's in a covenant, and the covenant's like a marriage. Then we should expect that God would be zealous for his people. I am zealous for my spouse. Hopefully you are too if you're married. It's part of marriage, right? And then if he's zealous for his people that he's in covenant with, then we should expect that he will be intolerant of other gods. It makes sense that his first commandment is, "You shall have no other gods. I'm in a covenant with you. It's like a marriage. There's nobody else. It's you and me." That makes sense to us, right? No rival gods. And we should expect that he would be vigilant in guarding and protecting his people, right? That's why he pulls them out of slavery. That's why he helps them cross the Red Sea. That's why he promises that he's going to get them to the promised land. Because he is vigilantly protecting and guarding his people to be a people for himself, to be set apart, to be in relationship with him. That makes sense. He's in covenant with them. It's like a marriage. He wants to do good things for them, not for himself, for them. And this is how we expect a husband to feel towards his wife, so we should understand why God feels this way. And in saying that we would expect all of this from the God who loves his people with a greater love than we could ever comprehend, then we are, by our own logic, defining God as a jealous God. By saying it makes sense that God would protect his people against rivalry, and he would guard them with this deep guarding, then we are describing him as a jealous God. And for some of us, we hear that and we go, "I don't know if I like hearing that God is jealous," but let's just consider this. We know that God is love, and he burns with an incredible passion for his people. And we know that he is holy, and he is right, and he is just, and he is perfect. And we know that he's faithful. He's made a promise to his people to say, you will be my people, and I will bring you to the promised land. I will bring you to myself. So if he is perfect love, and he is perfectly holy and good, and if he is completely faithful, then how on earth could he allow his people to wander off to other gods? How could he allow that? A God of love and a God who's holy and a God who's perfectly faithful could never allow that. And so of course he's a jealous God. Of course he's a God that when he sees us drifting away, he gets upset. And his anger is enraged and it burns. And he says, no, that's not best for you. I know what's best for you. I am God, okay? I created you. Everything else is false. Everything else is trying to say that it'll bring you happiness, that it's going to give you whatever you need, that it's, you know, this God for his, the people there, all the people around the Israelites were saying, well, we have the sun God and the moon God and this God, and we need to worship them all for our seasons to work out. And God's saying, you don't need any of that. You need me, okay? You were made for relationship with me. Anything short of that, you will not be happy. God knows that. So of course he's jealous for his people. And it's through his holy jealousy that we're better able to then understand and appreciate the remainder of this verse in Exodus. For when I stopped right here, the verse on the screen, that's halfway through verse 5. And I'll be honest, as preachers, sometimes it's tempting when you get to a really hard verse to want to stop and say, I'll just stop my message here because I don't want to unpack what's next. But because I said we don't do that and we want to teach the whole of God's word, let's continue and see what the rest of verse 5 says. Verse 5 is, you shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of their parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. Reading those verses can be really challenging to our faith, can't they? We look at that and go, I wish you had stopped where you stopped before, but I can't. I can't just teach on verse 5a. I have to teach verse 5b. And this is where we get to, that God says he's punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. And that's a really hard verse. I don't have time to unpack it to completion, but at the same time, I can't skip it. Okay, so here's the short answer for how we're to understand how this fits with God's jealousy. The first thing we need to understand is that he doesn't actively punish anyone for their parents' sin. God doesn't actively punish you because of the sin of your parents. He won't punish your children or your grandchildren because of something you did. That's not how God works. However, there are natural consequences for our sin. Many of us are familiar that if you grew up in the home of an alcoholic, you have a greater tendency to be an alcoholic. You have a greater tendency to deal with different sins in your life because of the consequences of the sin of your parent. Okay? If you grow up with really materialistic parents, you are going to have a greater tendency to be more materialistic yourself. The sin of the parents isn't punishing you, but it's being passed down through the natural consequences being felt through the generations. And so I think that part of where God is saying that punishing the children through the generations, that is greatly meant to be through the natural consequences of how the sin of one parent affects the next generation. And we all can wrap our minds around that. We understand that. And the second thing that we have to understand here is where God says punishing the children, I think part of that is the idea of discipline. He isn't punishing, he isn't giving these consequences just to cause suffering, just to punish them to say, oh, you're going to walk away from me? Fine, I'm going to smite you, I'm done with you. No, when God punishes, the reason is to ultimately bring his people back to him. It's to restore and to reconcile that relationship, not to cut it off, but it's a discipline to bring them back to himself. His jealousy is never against you, it's for you, And we have to understand it's for our good. Many of us are parents, and when we have kids who mess up, we know that we have to discipline them to teach them how to grow up. We understand that. You can't just let them fall away, do whatever they want, and say, fine, I love you and do whatever you want. I don't care. I'm done with you. Like, your five-year-old would be like, really? Why? What did I do? Like, that'd be completely unfair, right? We punish, we discipline so that we can restore the relationship so that we can teach them. I think that that's what God's saying here. I'm a jealous God, and when you walk away from me like an unfaithful lover, when you go following the whatever is the desire of your heart, I will punish you. And that punishment will be felt through the generations. But it's not because I'm actively punishing them all. It's because I'm disciplining you, trying to bring you back. And ultimately, your sin may have influence down the generations of your family. That's just fact. But moving on, as we can see, the purpose of God's jealousy being for our good, we see this in the very next verse. He continues. So we have the punishment side, but then right in verse 6, he continues by saying, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commands. Ultimately, God's jealousy is for our own good. It's to keep us in our Father's love, to protect us from all the false lovers that the world parades right in front of us. When we watch TV, when we pick up a newspaper, when we pick up a magazine, there are so many things that are vying for our attention. When we go to work, there are so many people. When we walk down the street, when we watch a movie, there's all these people who are vying for our affection. And the world is running all these things in front of us as lovers, as idols that we might pick up. And God is saying, no, I'm a jealous God, and I will punish you if you pick those things up, not to destroy you, but to bring you to myself, because ultimately I want to show love to 1,000 generations of those of you who love me. My jealousy is to protect you so that you stay in your love relationship with me. So what does it mean for us that God has a holy zeal, a godly jealousy for us and our affection? First, it means that we need to examine our lives and make sure that we aren't arousing his jealousy with anything in our lives that we have made an idol of. And we have to understand, idols in our lives in 21st century America look very different than 4,000 years ago in the time of Moses. We tend to not have wood carvings in our home or stone statues of gods that we worship and we bow down to and pray. But that doesn't mean that we don't have idols in our homes. We do have a plethora of activities, hobbies, treasures, and even people that we put in front of God in our lives. Maybe it's your finances that you have made an idol in your life. Maybe it's the almighty dollar. And when you think of this, you realize you're the type of person that you're very unwilling to give any money to the church, to give any money to somebody that you see in need. You know, maybe you know somebody who's going through a really tough time, and you're like, oh, man, you know, I can give you a five. And they're like, okay, thank you. But you're holding on to your money with clenched fists because it's all about your security. It's all about your future. It's all about the thing that you want to buy with that money. And you've made money an idol. Maybe you work countless hours, ultimately, to increase your income and to build your bank account. And you say, well, it's just part of the job, but you're allowing this countless working of the hours to interfere with any time that you have for God. When somebody says, hey, when was the last time you prayed or spent time reading the Bible? You're like, oh, I wish I could, but man, that job, I'm just working 70, 80 hours. And you're like, well, why are you working 70 or 80 hours? Is it something that you need to do? Is it something that God's put you there and it's honoring God? And it may be. I'm not saying it's not. But is it something that you're so driven to work those hours because you know the more hours you work, the more money you make, the happier that you think you can become with the stuff that you buy? And your stuff and money and finances are the idol in your life, and you haven't even realized it. Maybe you worship your hobby or your special interests. You skip church each Sunday to golf or maybe to spend time on your property or maybe to go work out for the next 5K that you signed up to run. And none of these things are inherently bad. This is the thing about idols in America in the 21st century. Typically, they're things that are good. Golf is fine. Working out is fine. Go into, you know, a cabin or the woods or wherever that you like to go and play and relax. All those things are good. The problem is when we get our priorities upside down and we put these other things on top of God and we put God in the closet and we only pull him out on Sundays. That's when we run into a problem. When anytime anybody asks you, hey, can you be a part of this program or can you help serve in the church or can you come on Wednesday to this meeting? I can't, I'm sorry, I'm so busy. I've got to do this, I've got to do that. Your mind's always thinking about that hobby. You're always focused on what you need to buy, the next golf club, the newest this, the newest that. That everything consumes you there, and as a result, you never make time for God. At that point, your hobby, your special interest is the idol because God is underneath. Honestly, even your children or your spouse might have become an idol in your life. If you love your child more than God, if you're willing to sacrifice your relationship with God so that your child is able to be at every sporting event, every band competition, that your child can go do whatever they want to do. You're there. You're driving them around early in the morning, after school, late at night, the weekends. Your whole calendar is dictated by your children. At that point, perhaps, you've made your child and their happiness your God. And your child looks at you and doesn't even see a parent who's making God first. That's a problem. These are the situations. These are good things. And I'm not going to tell you to smash these idols because you can't smash your children, right? In the Old Testament, God said, smash your idols. They knock down the Asherah poles, whatnot. But we need to learn how to set our idols aside because God, his jealousy is aroused when we put anything over and above him. So what we need to do is we need to first examine our lives for these idols. And that can be a really challenging thing. And then we need to confess them as sin in our lives. And we have to say, God, I understand I've been doing this wrong. I have made you second when you need to be first. Forgive me. And then we have to remove them. We have to say, you know what? I am putting them back in their rightful position. In some places, you may need to boycott that. You may need to say, you know what? I get myself in trouble when I'm always on the internet shopping for these things or looking at these things. I need to stop doing that for a while. Or I need to stop going to my vacation home or that cabin for a while and I can make myself right with God. I need to do what it takes to remove these idols in my life and put God back at his place of preeminence. Here's the thing we need to recognize, and I know it's hard and it steps on our toes, but God demands to be first and primary in our lives. He's not just a God that we can pick up on Sunday and bring him to church and put him in the closet. Set him back down. When we do that, we're acting as nominal Christians, and essentially at that point, we're being polytheists. A polytheist is somebody who worships many gods. Some of us absolutely do that here. We have this thing that's so important to us, and we have this thing that's so important to us. And we have God, and he's important to us, but he's one of the many. And God says, I don't want to be one of the many. The first commandment is that you have one God, and that's it. And so anything that we elevate to the status of God in our lives of such great importance that it's consuming all of our time and attention, God's saying, no, that's no good at all. Just like he says to the church of Laodicea in the book of Revelation, he says, I would rather you be hot or cold than be lukewarm in the middle. If you're lukewarm, I'm just going to spew you out of my mouth. Some of us live that life, though. And what it does, when we live this nominal Christianity, it arouses God's jealousy inside of him. He loves us too much to let us think that we're living the good life by playing around with all these things that weren't meant to be primary in our lives. He's meant to be first. And ultimately, at the end of time, he recognizes we may not have the life we wanted to have when we're just living this nominal Christianity, making God one of many. He wants to be the only God in our lives. He's not okay being a part of your life. He loves you too much. His holiness and his faithfulness to his covenant won't allow him to let you go worship at the feet of other lovers. You're too valuable for him to allow you to just throw your life away like that. And as I list those possible examples of idols in your lives, you need to search yourself and see what you have elevated above God. Second thing we must do is be zealous for God. In a marriage relationship, it's really kind of messed up if one spouse has this incredible love and zealous attitude to protect and be with the other partner, and the other one's like, I'm indifferent, right? That'd be really weird. So our response to God's zealous love for us is to be zealous back with Him. To say, you know what, God, I agree. I need to do things to purge the rivals out of this relationship so that we can be closer together. And three practical ways that we can protect our relationship with God are, first, that we recommit to our relationship with Him. Some of you just need to say, God, I need to make you first. What I'm hearing Ryan say, it makes a lot of sense. I've screwed this up. I'm going to reprioritize your first. Okay? For some of you, it's that simple. For some of you, that recommitment might say, you know, I've never been baptized. I've been following you, Jesus, but I haven't taken that step. I want to take a public step of faith so that everybody sees, no, I have decided to follow you, Jesus. Your next step is you need to be baptized to show that you are zealous for God and you are obedient. For others of you, you need to get into some sort of a group, an accountability group. We have a bunch of those at our church. We have Sunday school classes. We have small groups. We have discipleship groups. All these groups are ways for people to challenge each other, to talk about what might be the idol in their lives, and to, like iron sharpens iron, live out a life that honors God. I encourage you, maybe if you're not in one of those groups, that's your next step, to commit to being zealous for God. Maybe your step that you need to do is that you need to guard your devotional time. I've already mentioned this briefly. Here's what a guy told me while I was going through seminary. So I knew I wanted to be a pastor, and I was finding no time for devotional time with God. I wasn't really reading my Bible unless it was instructed to me in a class, because you had so much Bible reading for that. My only Bible reading was when a professor said, read this. My prayer time was maybe at mealtime. I was just busy. And he said, Ryan, do you have time for devotions? I said, no, I'm just way too busy. And he said, if you're too busy to make time to be with God, what you are telling God is that school and your work at the church at the time and your family are all more important. They've taken away all your time and God gets none. And that's a problem. So I won't say it that harshly to you all, but I'll let his word speak to you. Okay? And the third thing that we need to do is we need to be intolerant of the things that are popping up in our hearts that threaten to rival our devotion to God. This isn't a one-time examination of our lives for idols. It's an ongoing thing. We have to constantly be looking. What might be turning from a good thing to a bad thing because it's taking preeminence in my life? And part of being zealous is when we realize something's jumping in that position, say, nope, not now. I'm too zealous for God to allow that to get in between me and Him. He won't allow it, He doesn't want it, and I don't want it either. You see, God's jealousy isn't just a fancy way of saying He has a whole bunch of love for us. It's more than just the feeling of love. It's the protective, purifying, pursuing form of love that God has for us. His jealousy is never to harm us, but it's always to draw us closer to Him. Just like God was jealous for the Israelites in the time of Moses, promising to punish them if they worshiped other gods or show them love if they kept His commandments, He is jealous for us. Through the death of Jesus Christ on the cross and our accepting His blood for the forgiveness of our sins, we have become God's chosen people. We have stepped into this covenant. We've been grafted in just like the Israelites. And we're now in this marriage relationship with God. That's where we are when we say we're Christians and followers of Jesus. And so because of that, He jealously works to guard us from other lovers. And one of the great things He does for us is He's given us the Holy Spirit. We forget that sometimes. The Holy Spirit convicts us of our sin, not so that we feel guilty of our sin, but so that we run from our idols. It protects our relationship with God. In fact, God does all that He can, short of stepping on our free will, to guard us against rival affections, to keep us holy. Truly, God's jealousy is for our good. We have to recognize that. When we read through the Bible and we see God is jealous, I hope it reminds you of today. God's jealousy is for our good. It's not that envy. He's not envious of us, that sinful way. It's a jealousy that says, I am so passionate about you. I will not allow you to do anything that tears you away from me. It's who I am. It's in my being. And so we need to respond to his zeal for us with our own single-minded zeal for him, our Creator and Redeemer.